CityTalk 105.9 official podcasts online at citytalk.fm.
This is Talk to Trisha on CityTalk 105.9.
To call Fiona Jones a survivor could well be the understatement of the year so far. An abusive childhood sparked the severe mental health problems that defined and nearly destroyed her early life. She's battled drug and alcohol addiction, she's attempted suicide and armed robbery, and spent years in secure psychiatric units. The fact that she's come out the other side of all of this is even more remarkable when you consider that Fiona was also coming to terms with the sudden death of her dear husband and being separated from her two children. But Fiona did indeed survive, and she has made an astonishing recovery. Since her discharge from hospital in 2005, she's become a campaigner for mental health issues. She's also been a national representative for the charity Mind and the chairman of the charity Lancashire Advocacy, which acts for people with mental health problems and learning disabilities. So, Fiona, welcome to City Talk.
Hello.
Now, Fiona, you're the first armed robber, I think, female armed robber that I've interviewed. Not to take it too lightly, but tell me about the armed robbery. Where were you? What did you do?
Really, it was an argument that I'd had with my husband about money. And I had an old service revolver from my father-in-law who'd died previously. And it just entered my head that I had to go out and get some money, and I knew how I was going to do it, and I knew that I was going to be caught and taken out of the situation.
When you say you knew how to do it, were you sort of, did you spend nights thinking about it or planning it? Or
no, it wasn't so much of a plan. I just walked in and I just told her to hand over the money, really. It was pretty much like watching it on telly and then doing it, really.
This is an off-licence that you entered
into? Yeah.
Were you nervous, drugged, anxious, what?
I was terrified because I expected everything to sort of go really smoothly and really calmly. But obviously the lady was really, really scared, which I hadn't really thought about, actually. That was the thing that I didn't think about. And with her being scared, that made me feel very scared also.
So when you told her to hand over the money, what did she do?
She screamed and she ran into a back room
and
locked herself in. I raided the till and ran.
And then what happens next?
A couple of days later, I was just on my way out to the shop and
So hang on, you get home with this money. Did
yeah.
you tell your husband what you'd done, or did you tell anybody?
Yeah, I told my husband what I'd done.
What did he say?
He was blown away, really.
Well, he couldn't believe it?
No, he couldn't believe it at all. It was the sort of thing, probably, the way that we were living our lives at the time, it was more the sort of thing he would have done with his mates than I would have done on my own. As you said at the top of the show, it is very rare for females to commit this type of offence. I mean, I only ever met one other whilst I was in prison and hospital.
Yeah. And what did you, I mean, did you sleep at night? Because we've got to look at it from the other side of the coin. And you have said that you felt so awful for the fear that you put that woman through. But did you sleep at night?
No. It was at that point when she looked at me and she screamed, and I just realised at that point that I had just gone completely too far. And I'm sure she still sees me. Although I was covered up, she'll have an image of me, and she did come to the court, and so she knows what I look like.
So you saw her at the court, didn't you?
Yeah.
How did that feel?
Really, really, really strange. And I was trying to look like I was trying to look like small as Anna, sort of thing. I was trying to hide away, really, because I didn't want this to be me that they were talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Now you said you knew you would be caught, and you were what, walking around? How did they catch you?
They caught me because initially I'd ran to my friend's house. And I dumped the gun, and the baseball cap and everything at his house. But I hadn't worn any gloves or anything like that. And a couple of days later, this friend actually walked into the police station and said, I know who did that robbery, and he has the gun and she lives there.
So he was, you call him a friend, so he really was a friend by turning you in?
At the time, I didn't think he was much of a friend, but to be honest, I'm glad he did. I'm glad he did now, yeah.
So to that woman in the off-licence, you were just a female with a voice and a gun telling her to hand over the money. But what I'd like to do is go back to the beginning. Your childhood, how would you describe that?
It was good in some parts. I have very early memories of my nan and my maternal grandmother, but she died when I was four. And it was after that, really, that things started to change for us. We moved house, and my dad was very, very violent, not just with me, but also with my brothers as well.
How did you deal with that?
At the time, I used to run away a lot. I self-harmed a lot. I bullied other kids at school, but I got bullied as well. It was just a crazy life,
I was going to say, was it chaotic?
Very chaotic, because I didn't know what was waiting for me when I got in.
Yeah. And what could be waiting for you? What sort of things?
It would be fists or belts, or if something really, really annoyed him and he just had something in his hand, he'd throw that at you, regardless of what it was. Pint glasses, all sorts, is.
And what about your mum? What would your mum do?
My mum's really, really quiet, and she didn't stand up at all. She just refuses to sort of understand, really.
Just sort of zoned out,
she has.
So when did you get away from home?
I was 14 when I got away from home.
God, that's young, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I got taken into care eventually. And, then I entered the care system, which was horrendous.
I was going to say, what was the care system back then? Because initially you must have felt relieved, that you were getting out until you realised what you got into.
Well, I did. I felt relieved because I remember going to the kids' home, and I can remember them saying that I was allowed to smoke. Well, I was absolutely amazed. So I sat down on the settee and I had a cigarette, and I was thinking, wow, well, I can put up with this if I can smoke. Yeah. It must be great. Only the other kids who were in the kids' home were going out that night to start glue sniffing. Well, I'd never heard of anything like that in my life. So although it was a relief to be away from home, it also marked the beginning of a really dodgy lifestyle.
So it was glue sniffing. What else did other habits did you pick up in the children's home?
The self harm continued, and some of my major suicide attempts were done in children's homes.
What triggered those? Was it just the sense of not having had any sort of anything there, or feeling that anyone was caring for you?
Yeah, I just felt like almost like my family had given me to an Oxfam shop, as if I was an old teddy that was just left on the shelf somewhere. And, I was between a rock and a hard place. I didn't know whether I wanted to go back home or whether I wanted to stay where I was.
Were you an angry child? You talk about self-harm, and that's turning anger in on yourself.
Yeah.
What else, what other things did you do to try and, scream for help?
Well, drugs started playing a significant part, and alcohol when I was older, obviously. I think when I was younger, I took it out on other kids more. If I got hit at home, I'd make sure that when I went to school the next day, I'd hit someone else.
Yeah. And in your care home, just coming back to care, you were the only girl in your first care home.
Yeah.
How did you cope with that?
To be honest, there isn't that many girls in care homes. It used to be quite male-orientated.
Yeah.
It was really difficult because all of them want to be your boyfriend, basically.
Oh, gosh.
And so you feel almost like you're being stalked from from minute to minute. You don't know who's going to be talking to you next and why they're going to be talking to you. You know, it's it's hard.
Did it shape? Do you think it shaped your view of what men were?
I think my views of men had already been shaped before that.
By your father?
Yeah, but it reinforced the fact that, you know, men basically could do whatever they wanted, really, and that women had to be subservient, because that's the way it was.
So did you have any contact with your parents during those 5 years in care?
Yeah, they came to see me.
How was that?
That was strange, because the first time they came to see me, I was in a secure unit in the northeast for young people, and that was pretty strange, because my mum came in and she was crying because she realised that I'd gone from their house to being locked up, and she couldn't understand why. And I used to get blamed quite a lot for the effects it was having on my younger brother.
What, you being locked up?
Me, yeah, having to visit me and not having a childhood himself. So that just reinforced my uselessness, really.
Hmm. And what about seeing your father? How did he react to seeing you in a secure unit? Did he equate anything he'd done with where you ended up?
No. They always said that it was because there was something wrong with me. You know,
nothing wrong with their parenting.
No.
Okay, let me just remind people, you're listening to Talk to Tricia here on City Talk 105.9, The Voice of Liverpool. I'm talking to Fiona Jones about, at this stage, were you seen as being bad by your parents and mad by the authorities?
Pretty much. I think they thought I was just a kid that went off the rails and I was just sort of kicking against my parents anyway. Because I didn't actually disclose what was happening to me until quite a bit later. Nobody could put the finger on what it was that was wrong with me.
When was that, and how come they did actually say what was wrong with you?
I got to 16 and I'd already been in a secure unit once, and I thought, I'm going to have to tell someone why I feel so angry and why I'm acting out all the time, and that's what I did.
Who did you tell?
I told a foster parent that I was staying with at the time, and she was really nice, and she stayed up with me all night that night. Oh. Just let me talk. Very rare.
Yeah, I was going to say, that must have been a first, that somebody actually listened to you rather than reacted to you.
Yeah.
And what diagnosis, what label did they give you? That's a whole other subject about labels, but what label did they give you?
When I was younger, they said that I had a borderline personality disorder, which I don't agree with, because they say that quite a lot, actually. Yeah. They diagnose
too hard
a lot
basket,
of people.
Usually, isn't it?
Yeah, but it wasn't until I was 28 when they said that I actually had schizoaffective disorder and needed medication.
28? Yeah. For people who don't know what schizoaffective disorder is, can you describe that?
It's a bit like schizophrenia, but it's a mood disorder with schizophrenic symptoms like visions and voices and paranoia and stuff.
Did you hallucinate?
Yeah, I've hallucinated quite a few times. More so around the death of my husband. I hallucinated quite badly one night. I still have them from time to time.
Yeah.
It'll never go completely. But back then it was really horrible.
Now, you had your first child very early, didn't you?
Yeah, when I was 17, yeah.
Gosh, did you know what was happening to you? I know that sounds stupid, but you know what I mean? It's the idea is one thing, the actuality is something totally different, isn't it?
Well, yeah, the actuality is totally different, because he's a teenager now, and I think if someone had told me what it was like looking after a teenager rather than a baby, I might have.
Yeah, I know. I'm with you. Baby's easy, bit, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think a lot of girls in care. I think they get pregnant on purpose. I mean, I certainly did. I was just hell bent on I'm going to have a baby and I'm going to get out of here.
What did you? Did a baby equal freedom, or did a baby equal someone to love you and care for you?
Well, it's a bit of both, really. I knew that I couldn't stay in care if I had a baby, but also I really wanted to start my own family off and break the cycle, really, of what had happened with mine.
But did you? Did you manage to do that? I mean, I'm trying to think of a 17-year-old girl with a baby just out of the care system. How hard would that have been?
No, it was impossible. Mm. What actually happened was he actually went to live with my parents.
Right.
Because I was given a choice of whether he was adopted or went to live with my parents. And
what a hellish choice.
Well, I couldn't let him go. I mean, in hindsight, probably now I'm a bit older, I would have made a different choice. But at the time, I just couldn't bear not to see him.
Would you? Do you think now you would have chosen to have him adopted?
I think, knowing the problems I have and the problems that he's had, yes, probably.
Yeah, because you talked about breaking the cycle, so I guess you're not going to be able to do that if he had to go back and stay with your parents.
No.
And what about was it a relationship that you had with his father?
Yeah. It was really good, actually. You know, we used to go out to the pub and we'd go out for meals and this, that and the other. But he was from quite a good background, and I don't think that he'd... I don't think his family were very pleased that he'd got someone pregnant, and I think they were less pleased that I was in care.
Was he around the same age as you, or older?
No, he was older. He was 7 years older than me.
Now, that relationship didn't last, and you eventually met your husband.
Yeah.
How did you meet him?
I was at a friend's house. And he was at the same friend's house, and he'd been fixing a car earlier on because he was a mechanic. Oh. And he was sat there doing the crossword, and I just went and helped him with it, and that was it.
And was he older as well?
Yeah, he was 17 years older than me, yeah.
Was he ever, I suppose you've been asked this a million times, was he in many ways a stabilising or a father-type figure for you?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. He was... It was very comforting.
Yeah. And good, loving relationship?
Yeah, it was good, yeah.
So what started going wrong to end up with you having an argument and going out and robbing an off-licence?
It's just a slow decline, I think. I mean, we were both on drugs when we met.
What drugs were they?
We were on amphetamines when we met.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. But that progressed into... Temgesic, cyclozine, morphine, and then it went on to heroin in the end.
Were you self-medicating, do you think, in hindsight?
Definitely, because when I was 14 and had my first admission to hospital, I was in an adult psychiatric hospital, the only thing they knew what to do with me was to feed me with Largactyl during the day and temazepam at night time. So when I got out of there, I didn't have that anymore, and I think I just searched for anything that would make me feel that way.
Yeah, yeah. Just to remind people, you're listening to Talk to Tricia here on City Talk 105.9, The Voice of Liverpool. I'm talking to Fiona Jones. Fiona, you just mentioned that, being in an adult psychiatric ward. I mean, it's something, wish that we had a magic wand, and it would never, ever happen again, that you'd have... you know, early intervention systems across the country. But how terrifying was that?
That was really terrifying, because the first place I ever went to, it was a really old Victorian hospital, and there was a lot of people there, and for the first time in my life I met people who were only in hospital because they'd had a baby in the 60s, or
yeah, that's right.
You know, they'd done something really, really minor, and then because they'd been there 30 plus years, they'd gone mad because they were there.
They were institutionalised to do the hilt as well. So did you find prison easier to deal with?
I've never really, I don't think prison is easier to deal with because people don't really understand so much there. And they're very frightened within the system of mental illness. So if you're mentally ill in prison, you end up on either a special wing or you end up in segregation. So,
and there are a lot of women with mental, a lot of people with mental health problems in prison as well.
Oh, massive! It's a massive problem. A massive problem. I found when I was doing my mind work, something like something bordering on 70% of women.
I've got what, a psychiatric problem.
Yeah.
Gosh.
And many more go on to develop it through losing the children and the homes and this, that and the other. It's a very tough place to be when you're mentally ill.
And for you, when you, as you say, you were in prison mentally ill, were you at least given a reprieve from the drugs? Were the illegal ones taken away? I don't know, maybe legal ones given to you?
That didn't really happen until I was transferred to Ashworth. Because in prison, obviously, it's really easy to get hold of drugs in prison. There's masses of drugs in prison. So you just sort of carry on what you were doing before. But when I got to Ashworth, that was when they really started to say to me, right, you need to take this tablet and that tablet. And they weaned me off and got me on the barrage of psychiatric drugs instead.
from illegal to legal, from self-medication to system medication, where therein again lies something else. But why and how did you get into advocacy work? Because up until now, you feel very much, and what you're talking about was as a victim. And I understand when you were in prison, you lost your husband just before?
I'd been in prison 6 weeks when he died.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
What, and they just came and told you just like that?
Yeah, they just came and opened my cell and they got me and they took me to a room and they said, I'm sorry, your husband's died. And then they took me back to my cell and locked me up again.
And that's when they knew you had mental health problems anyway?
They knew before then, yeah. Yeah.
And you by that stage you'd had a daughter to your husband, so what happened to her?
She unfortunately went into care because obviously he didn't go and pick her up from school that day.
A heart attack?
Yeah, heart attack in the kitchen.
Oh,
yeah. So he didn't go to pick her up, so we had to go and break the door down. She was taken into care that night. There was nothing I could do because I was away.
So you're in prison and you're dealing with being in prison, you're dealing with your mental health problems, mental illness in prison, and then your husband, they just tell you your husband's died, your daughter's gone into care.
Yeah.
You said before that your, I don't know, was it auditory or your hallucinations started really kicking in then?
Yeah, they did. I was seeing horrendous visions. I was seeing my husband stood at the end of my bed. I could hear him talking to me. It was just horrendous. It just felt like he was following me around everywhere. You know, I thought everyone was looking at me.
He could read your mind?
Well, yeah. I thought that one of the funniest things I did, I look back and think it's funny now. There was a smoke alarm in the one of the hospital rooms. And I became convinced that that was a receiver for the staff downstairs. So I climbed on something and put a tea towel round it, fastened on with the rubber band.
So they couldn't see you, or
so they couldn't hear me.
But I mean, how did you cope with literally going mad? I mean, what did you do?
Well, I didn't cope with it very well, Tricia. Actually, I at that point, I really seriously tried to commit suicide.
But they design prisons, don't they? So the shower rails don't hold, so everything... I mean, everything's designed to try to stop you doing that.
But so, nothing's designed for you to hide a razor blade.
Get anything.
Yeah, they thought of everything, but not quite everything. So I managed to get hold of a razor blade and I cut my carotid artery on my neck.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So what, you end up in a hospital then?
Yeah, I was rushed to hospital from the prison and then I was transferred back to the hospital wing at the prison.
Was that anger? Was it confusion? Was it chaos? Was it...
I just wanted everything to stop at that time. I mean, I was seeing and hearing things that just weren't there, and I knew
you
they weren't.
You probably weren't
there.
Sleeping either.
No. Sleep was really affected. I wasn't eating very much. I had the court case coming up, and I just thought, I just wanted everything to stop.
Yeah. It's all going too fast.
Yeah.
When did the turnaround come then? Because here you are now. You've done, done a lot of very positive work.
Yeah.
How did you get from that person who is living in absolute chaos, not wanting to see the next day, to the Fiona I'm talking to now?
I think, the transformation began in 2003, and I'd been transferred to a medium secure hospital, and it was really therapeutic, and it was really good, and it had a really good occupational therapy department. It had really good psychologists. It wasn't medication-led, so a lot of our medication was taken away so we could be who we really were.
So we're talking therapies introduced and things like that?
Yeah, yeah. You know, things that actually really do help, and cognitive behaviour therapy and everything like that. And it was the advocacy service came in to see me. And we used to have patient groups in the hospital, and we used to moan about the food and the temperature and this, that and the other. But then people started asking me about legal things and policies and procedures and the sections and things like that. And I thought, oh, well, who's going to listen to me? But Lancashire Advocacy did listen to me and asked me to be their hospital rep.
Because obviously, as someone who's been through it, you are the expert.
Yeah, that's what they said.
Without realising it.
Well, yeah. And that just, it's just snowballed from there, really.
But did it give you a sense of purpose?
It gave me my life back. I never thought that I would ever do anything like this. I never thought I'd be trusted to do anything like this. I never thought anyone would listen to me. I thought everyone would look at my past. And it's just given me an entirely brand new start on life in a completely different direction to the one I thought I was going on even 10 years ago.
So do you think if somebody had told you, if you could go back to that angry young girl, if you'd said, hey, look, this is what the future holds, you wouldn't have believed it, would you?
No. I was planning on not being around after I was 30.
Really?
Yeah.
What age did you start planning that?
Very young, 11, 12. I knew I wouldn't... Well, I thought I wouldn't make it to 30.
That's so sad, isn't it? And there are a lot of other kids in the same situation.
Oh, there is, yeah.
So just explain to us what it is that you do now in your work with the Lancashire Advocacy.
What we do is we host a number of projects for people with mental health problems and learning disabilities. And some of our projects are used to train people like the police, local hospitals, and the Veterans Agency, all that sort of thing, the Mental Health Helpline. They actually do training.
How do you train the police? I mean, because you would have been... What do you think was done unto you, that you would not wish to be done unto any other person with mental illness?
Well, there has been a lot of changes in the police recently. I think they're coming round to the idea that they're not to be frightened of mental illness. I think that's the way people react. It's a lot to do with them being frightened of mental illness and only seeing mental illness as a whole person instead of just a small part of that person.
But isn't one of the fears that people like the police and, you know, there's different services, one of the fears they have about people with mental illness and it's, you know, is that they are violent? And surely they would say, well, there you are, that Fiona held a gun to somebody, there you are, these mad people are violent, they will kill you.
People do tend to think we run around with axes, but actually the statistics actually show that people with mental illness are more likely to be attacked themselves, and in fact there won't even be a conviction after that either. A lot of mentally ill people are abused and they are assaulted, and they just don't report it because
They don't think they're
not,
worth it.
No, and it's not taken seriously sometimes.
Do you think your violent episode, or when you got to that point of robbing the bank, was probably more about the drugs? Because you said as well amphetamines, which are notorious for anger and impetuousness and just doing something without thinking it through.
Yeah, it was definitely drug-fueled. But I knew that this was, it was sort of culmination, and I knew something big was going to happen after that, and
You'd get caught.
Well, yeah, I knew I would get caught.
And then what did you hope would happen once you got caught?
I hoped that I would just be removed from the situation.
The stress.
Yeah, because also at the time we were looking after my husband's mother who had Alzheimer's as well.
Right.
And that was very... very hard, and she didn't like me, and that was how we started arguing.
So when you talk to, for instance, the police, do you talk to them about, I mean, there's a lot of talk about death by cop, that a lot of people with mental illness, or not a lot of, it has been known, people with mental illness, especially men, goading police into either shooting them. There was a guy with a table leg, I think. There have been many instances where the coroner has said, well, actually, this, and I know not just in England, in Australia as well.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of talk about if police were trained, they would recognise those situations.
I think they would, but I think they're getting better with the weapons now. I think they're more inclined now to taser you rather than shoot you.
Yeah.
I think that, and I'm glad that that's moved on, because through my years in hospitals, I've heard of people talking about this, about, oh, when I get out, I'm going to go down the main street and I'm going to have a gun and they're going to shoot me down in the street.
People actually talk about that. They actually see that as a way of committing suicide.
Yeah, yeah, there's many different ways.
Yeah, yeah.
And what better way than to get someone else to do it? Really, a lot of the time it is for them, and it's the you know, almost like a bravado thing as well. They're not doing it themselves. Mm. It's someone else doing it.
So coming back to the work that you do, I mean, there's a wealth of information and experience that you can, I mean, I'm hoping just by talking about your experiences this evening, it makes people think again, think behind the actions. Is that what you seek to do, as well as helping people who have mental illness?
Yeah, I think it's very easy to say to people, think before you do something. Mm. I'm just really lucky that there was a charity there that helped, and has helped a lot of people. And there should be more such projects around, but obviously... with the economic crisis and that, funding's being pulled left, right and centre for the charities.
So you try, as the Lancashire Advocacy, trying to raise money to keep going?
Yeah, we're actually nearing to being on the verge of closure, which means we're going to lose 5 projects for people.
Projects like what? What sort of projects are we going to lose?
There's Preston People First, which is part of a national charity, but they have to find their own funds, and that's the one that I run, and that's for people with learning disabilities, helping them speak up for themselves and others, really, about where they want to live and, you know, what job they want to do and stuff like that. And there's the training project, like I've previously told you about.
Training police and so on.
And there's the mental health project that actually influences local services. And we actually get commissioned to do some work for them.
And that's very important, because, again, instead of having others decide what is best for you, it's about giving the mental health user and their families more say in what happens.
Yeah.
And therefore it's nearly always more successful, isn't it?
Well, it is. When I think back about when I first went into hospital in 1988... and I was in a dormitory, and it was a mixed ward. The dormitory wasn't mixed, but it was very scary, and it only had curtains round the bed. And I think about the places now, which are quite nice. Most rooms are en suite now, single-sex wards, you know, good therapeutic intervention. Things have changed a lot.
And that's mainly because of the involvement
of service users,
exactly. So if people want to contact the Lancashire Advocacy, Fiona, I guess we should give them a number.
Yeah.
Do you have it there?
I have got it here. It's 01772 744050.
So that's 01772 744050.
Yeah.
And you've also got a website, haven't you?
We've got a website. And if people want to donate money to us, if you go to the Big Give website and they type in Lancashire Advocacy, it'll come up. It'll explain what I'm personally trying to do, which is to raise £50,000 to keep them going.
Right.
And they can just click on the Donate Now button and help me along.
Yeah, because I think what, I mean, it's already been recognised by the government that with the financial crises and the financial downturn, there may be a lot more people putting a lot more pressure on mental health systems.
So
groups such as yours actually needed more rather than less.
Well, yeah, because our numbers are going to increase, obviously.
Yeah.
People, you know, having mental health problems and things like that and needing to access services. But like you say, the government's pulling funding. But
yeah, they're a bit slow in that. Nobody's worked that one out. Let's hope they catch up.
Yeah.
So the Big Give, and if they go to Lancashire Advocacy, they can actually donate some money.
They can.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking to us, Fiona. Because, as I say, I started with the dramatic because that's how people would see it in the newspapers. But what I like to try and do is to get people to look about why this happened and what have you. And there's not for a minute that we're detracting from the poor woman who was at the end of your gun. Not for a moment, because she'd have her own mental health problems.
Yeah.
But you've managed to turn things around and assist a lot more people. So more power to you. Good luck in keeping the advocacy centre going, because I think it's a marvellous thing.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for talking to us.
Talk to Tricia on City Talk 105.9.
Listen, and log on to the Voice of Liverpool. City Talk 105.9.